everybody. Welcome to episode 116 of the Alexis Al podcast. And increasing the global reach of our podcast via a Talal Chachuti.
Hey.
Chachuti collection.
I'm not Hamas. Why are you saying my name like that?
I was trying to think of a joke.
Chachuti.
I've written Hamas / hummus. Has anybody attempted to elide those two things?
Yeah, I think
okay,
so.
Is that really obvious?
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's there was a Trump joke I did, a hummus and chips joke, but
really?
I have to recall it. But it's something about we need to stop Hamas and
right.
all the and the chi- it was the Chips Act,
right.
which was a thing in the United States.
The Chips
anyway,
Act.
Yeah.
And in my act, I have a song. One of my most popular songs about hummus. But it's an analogy. It's an analogy for British imperialism. And at one point in the song, I talk about how we pronounce it. And I say, if you're Israeli, you pronounce it chumos, something like that.
I should explain before we get any further. Our guest this afternoon, evening, is Tony Atamanik, who said it right?
Brilliant.
Who, Talal. Was connected to and mentioned on the podcast the other week, and so we've got global reach now, people. We're hoping to leech off your social media presence, Tony, to
good luck
Hoover up, get that BlackRock advertising endorsement.
Oh yeah,
we haven't. It's not that we object to advertising, it's just we've been holding out for the right truly evil one. Anyway, I don't know where this is going. Anyway, so
well, like,
Tony,
a couple weeks ago,
introduce Tony.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we had Stuart Lee on, and he asked us if we ever use any of our kung fu or meditation practices in our comedy. And
I mentioned
that, you know, right about 10 years ago, it feels like another life ago, I took part in a workshop called Mindfulness and Meditation in Improv. And it was run by Tony Atamanik. This is when there was a, this is to make a short story long, by the way. There was a group of UCB teachers came over to London to teach some improv courses. And one of the workshops was this. And I sat in there and Tony taught us all how to focus on our chi whenever we were freezing up on stage or losing ourselves, and then recentering yourself by focusing on your chi. And, yeah, that was the thing, and that stuck with me, and I still use it a lot. And
good.
Yeah, man. Since then, Tony's, he did like a world tour with Trump versus Bernie, yourself and James Adomian doing Sanders impression. And that got so popular, and it was so fucking funny. These improvised presidential debates between yourself and Bernie, or Trump and Bernie, and that got you picked up by Comedy Central, and you had the President's Show on Comedy Central. Aside from that, you've worked on 30 Rock and Kimmy Schmidt, and you're just an amazing improviser. Oh, bloody What We Do in the Shadows, you're a regular on
that.
You're
with
the next door
neighbor,
Brits, I think.
With my fellow Brits, with Matt Berry, who I just spoke to the other day.
And Kayvan Novak.
And Kayvan, the great Kayvan. Yes. And the meditation I remember that. That is a great, I think, for improv. That's it. Meditation is the only practice you could do outside of just doing it.
Wow. Okay.
Like you can't really practice improv because it's making it up. So like, how can you practice making it up? If you practiced it alone, that would be it. If you did it again, you're now doing something preconceived. So mindfulness is the only exercise you can do for the brain, right? Because it's the thing of giving space. It's all just about building space to find funnier shit. It's not anything more hippie. It's not any more sort of ethereal than that in my mind. It's just training your brain to have space. Right.
But you've made a lot of your living teaching improv with UCB. So is that all you teach in your classes as well? If you can't practice it outside of
when I used to teach near the end. Yeah. I mean, I stopped pretty much after you guys. Yeah. Because I got Trump and that was sort of it. But like I had a lot of people who took that course who ended up, you know, doing quite well in their careers. And I find that was probably the best thing I ever taught was just the simplest thing, which was sitting quietly for 20 minutes and breathing and clearing your mind. That turns out that was the key the whole time. All the other shit you do. Because doing comedy is sort of being shameless, right? I mean, you have to be shameless, which means you have to dissolve your ego in order to actually be funny, right? Because you have to be willing to sort of put yourself out in any way possible. I always feel comedy is about hiding in plain sight, letting yourself show through a character. So people go, God, that's so funny. That's so funny. That character's so crazy. And you're like, oh, but that's actually, there's a little piece of me there who's doing this, you know? Yeah. So I did the Trump with James, and we actually played the Leicester Square Theater. We had Mark Hamill was our moderator. That was a wild, that was like a wild experience. We went out to the Star Wars set and all that stuff with him.
Wow.
So I ended up making my hay for quite a while doing that sort of, you know, I would say I'm not a, you know, I'm not going to be on, you know, BBC Two being a mainstream funny. I'm not someone who's maybe family friendly or whatever. So I tried to make my hay doing that. And we're still actually, we have a podcast, sort of video podcast coming out where I'm playing RFK Jr. But the take on that is really the toxic culture of bro podcasting that was the sort of feed stop for all the politicians prior to the election. Yeah. And I assume you have that over there as well, which is there's this sort of new sort of ecosystem of, you know, kissing the ring or dinging the bell for this new form of, you know, I don't know if it's a new form of male comic, but I think it's a new actualization of that type of podcaster where they don't really have any stake in the game, right? They can kind of go, well, I don't know what I'm talking about. So whatever I endorse, whatever I put forward, it doesn't matter. I'm actually Teflon. I'm not connected to it. You saw that in the States in the run-up to the election, which is between Joe Rogan and Theo Vaughn and Andrew Schultz, all these figures in the U.S. who are these sort of pod bros. They all ushered Trump through, or RFK or whoever.
Yeah.
And they were able to sort of have fun. And I think often sometimes having fun, maybe even at Trump's expense, right? But ultimately, they were advancing him without any challenge. And, you know, that ecosystem was where RFK really lived. So we thought, well, what if we did a government podcast that was in the style of a bro podcast? And so
and that's with Adomian being Elon Musk as well, isn't it?
Well, Adomian will guest as Elon Musk. I actually have a friend of mine, Gil Azari, who's a very funny writer.
I love Gil, yeah.
And Gil, you know, writes for a lot of shows, including Big Mouth and stuff. So he's playing a sort of hybrid of all the other bro podcasters. And then I will be our... we've done one so far, but like a pilot, but we're about to start. And I think the idea is that we never really get to science or health advice or any government. It's always diverting into UFOlogy or supplements or, you know, whatever other garbage, you know. I mean, we're a garbage heap over here, but I feel like that disease is spreading now to everywhere.
Yeah. I don't know. Do we have bro podcasters here? I don't know.
It's not in the same vein, but there are those like apolitical laddie podcasts, and they are very, very popular. I'm not in that sphere, so I'm not in tune with it, but you do see the clips going around and they have a lot of views. And so you do have these kind of, apolitical laddie guys who just chat shit and they're funny. The clips I see are funny, but then I don't know, over the last few years, I've felt betrayed by anyone who has a platform and doesn't at least like signpost their politics a little bit, because the stakes are so fucking high at the moment and everything seems to matter so much more. It's not the 90s where nothing mattered. You know, doesn't feel like that anymore, no. You know.
I only listen to the radio, and the radio, there was an inventor in Britain. This has got nothing to do with anything. It was an inventor about 20 years ago or 30 years ago, was celebrated because he invented this clockwork radio for people in Africa. Mm. So you could wind it up and then listen to the radio for half an hour. But it made so much noise, kind of unwinding, that it was really impossible to listen to. But it seemed a bit patronized anyway, really. And he was celebrated at the time, though. Clockwork Radio. That's all I listen to, really, is a wind-up Clockwork Radio that brings me the news from a happier time.
Oh, you listen to news from the past?
Yeah.
I thought about doing that. I thought about recreating. What would it be like to, we have enough ability now, you could recreate a programming day, right, from another year. So you could sort of just immerse yourself in a whole other time. You could just set a whole day up of news broadcasts, the programming of one night, and just sort of take yourself out, which, I mean, I don't listen to any. This is the word. I don't really watch a lot of comedy, and I don't really listen. I actually listen to very little. I read, like, news, but I can't get into this world. I can't. It's been very hard to stay connected to this new world that we live in because it's too much overwhelming crap, you know?
Yeah, it certainly seems like that. So tell us how you we'll get back to the world of crap. But how did you get started? Your father's Ukrainian? Your surname is
Yeah. So my dad's – I'm a child of an immigrant. A Canadian immigrant. My grandmother and her sister, the sisters, they came over from Ukraine, I mean, to Saskatchewan sometime in probably the late 19th century. My great grandparents did. So they've been in Canada all through the 20th century.
So your dad hasn't gone all patriotic with.
No, you know, my aunt and my dad. I think when the first thing happened with Ukraine, I mean, here's the thing. My parents had my dad, my aunt had the sort of Ukraine thing. I sort of, you know, was like, oh, I guess the CIA operation finally failed over in the Ukraine. And, you know, I look at it and go, this has been what? It was 2006 to 2022, right? Was this sort of like money laundering operation that was going on?
Yeah.
You know, we spiked the Orange Revolution in order to try to crumble the you know, all of this being cleanup for our failure during the Soviet collapse. But anyway, so they were not. I don't know if they're that patriotic. My dad's more patriotic about Canada. I mean, Canadians are very into Canada.
And now or just always?
Always. You know, really? I find it funny because a lot of times, you know, Canadians will sort of be like, oh, America, you know, America's really crass or whatever. But I'll be like, you guys are just as sort of nationalistic and, you know, engaged. You're just like, you know, socialist. So you're a little better maybe than we are. But so my dad played music. He started playing in, you know, bands at 16, and he ended up playing with a number of popular bands in Canada, and ended up actually George Martin, who produced the Beatles, produced a band called Sea Train after the Beatles broke up, and with a guy named Peter Rowan and other folks. And so my dad joined that band, and so that was about 3 years of touring. And then he got with my mom, who was doing a national touring company of hair. She was a dancer.
Wow.
And so they got together and then, you know, got a little too wild. And then I showed up. and so much to their chagrin. And so then there was 6 years of questioning what the hell they did until they split. And then my dad moved on to end up performing with Emmylou Harris, and he performed with Dolly Parton. He plays mostly bluegrass music. He can play blues and rock and the whole nine, but he primarily stays within bluegrass. And he's known for his brushwork. He's like a very, very delicate brush guy. So I probably learned a lot from my dad about that.
On the drums, a bit.
Of course, on the drums, you fucking idiot.
Yeah.
I'm clarifying for the listener, you fuckhead.
My dad's one of the few drummers who does foot painting while he
keeps the place clean.
He's a cleaning studio
when everyone's.
You know what's
done,
funny?
Yeah.
He did work as a house painter, and he also did work as a housekeeper at one point. So he actually was an amazing brushman in those areas.
He was amazing at that too. Yeah. So you brought up in Canada?
I would spend my summers there. I would go there for vacations.
So I always think of Canadians as being kind of like Belgians to the United States. You know, Belgians to France is Canadians to the United States. Really, yeah. All the great heroes of French culture are, in fact, Belgian. All of them.
Yeah, that's true.
And same is true of Canada.
It is. Most of our celebrities in the States are Canadian, you know? And you know what they say. If it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium. So...
Interesting movie.
Yeah.
Critique of U.S. insularity. So how did you get – so tell me, let's chart your route through the – how did you get – well, and actually, I jumped from, what was working on Dirty Rock like? I mean, one of the greatest comedy shows of all time, I think.
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I was – at that point, I was a pretty small cog in the machine at 30 Rock. But fortunately, I knew Tina, from – my days improvising the theater. So I was playing one of the writers in the room, but I think I spoke one time in 6 years.
Right.
That was an amazing show to work on. I feel like I went to college for film theory and I never really, I never did any practical work though. I was always doing film theory and then doing comedy. And I would say that 30 Rock was like graduate school in how to do TV. Like, it was just like you learned everything about how to be on a set, how to deal with people, and how to keep a production moving. We worked with so many great people. Alec Baldwin, who ended up also doing a Trump.
Yeah.
Which you think the irony of two people working on the same show who both did notable Trumps in the same year and then had a public fight about it would be the strange.
Your Trumps had the public fight or...
Yeah. Well, Alec was, it's interesting. Alec, I don't think there was a person, Alec, Jane, Kurkowski, Tracy. It was, I think, pretty rare. It was a very familial experience. Everybody was very supportive. Before Alec and I didn't really talk much, he would come and see shows. He'd come and see a show you do. Locally, it was a very wonderful group of people, and it spawned all these really talented people who ended up going on to make other shows. And I was very grateful for it because it got me out of a pizza restaurant I was working at while I was,
Did you play a writer and also function as a writer?
No, well, I played a writer and I did Punch Up. I was never hired officially as a writer on that show. And then when later on, Tina
explain
would show
what Punch Up is to the to those people that don't know what it is.
Well, when I went to do Tracy Ullman's show in UK, that was interesting because Punch Up is just basically you take the script and you're giving alternative jokes or giving little shifts or changes, right, for the listening audience. And I found it was interesting when we did it for Tracy's show in the UK that it was more involved. Like I was coming in to play Trump, but they had me come in and like really work on my part of it. So it almost felt like writing whole segments of it, which I thought was very cool. Like normally Punch Up is more like almost like a sub focus group of writers where you bring the writers in, they read the script, they give notes, and then that stuff gets brought over to the people who wrote it. So it's a different experience.
Tina Fey must be, obviously she's very self-deprecating on that show, but she must have, what quality was it that got her to be head writer on Saturday Night Live?
I think that from my experience of Tina, the quality is that she is a completely authentic. She is who she is. She is exactly who she is. She's not putting on in any way. And she's hyper intelligent and all about the work. I mean, if there's any lesson I learned from her, it's like when you're making something, you need to know every part of it, right? So her investment, I think, had to do, and also I think that you have to be able to kill your darlings, right? You have to kill your babies right. constantly. And I think she was really good at killing great, you know, really funny ideas to hone the best, most funny idea. Right. And she knew how to, and also, I imagine from SNL, because I only auditioned there and I would go there to watch. I had a lot of friends on it, but I was never in that. But that place is apparently a meat grinder. And I think that one thing in my experience of being on a 30 Rock was that no one was precious. Like the biggest lead and the smallest person, if someone had an idea, then that idea was valuable. Right. So I feel like that's a good quality to have when you're, especially comedy is collaboration. So like, especially in comedy, to be precious is like, my God, like you're killing it. You're strangling it if you're being precious, you know. Now, right. I feel like 90% of the time what happens is a combination of of your planning and then whatever stuff presents itself. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
That's why poets are no good, you know. They won't change a word. Poets.
Yeah, poets.
They're very precious.
Well, it's one of the reasons why there's so few of them now. We've almost hunted them all down.
A lot of people call themselves poets, very few good ones.
I used to try. You know what? You know this in comedy, right? One of the best things about comedy is you get to wear hats that you would not that you want to wear, but you wouldn't want to actually wear as like a serious hat. So I used to do live shows where I would be Robert Frost just so I could write poems, right? You know, but I was like filthy Robert Frost because I read this thing about how Robert Frost was actually a disgusting perv. And so I would write these, like I would rewrite his poems to be sort of like filthy and ribald. And, you know, great. I think that's a way to disguise your ambitions, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well,
where would you do these shows?
Oh, at UCB downtown. So there was, they opened one on the
this
east
is
side
University
called
College Boston.
Upright Citizens Brigade.
I thought I knew something for certain because you told me that you were in Boston.
I was in New York that whole time. Yeah.
We'll explain UCB, but I need to let Tony know that Alexi hates improv, and and probably most of our listeners hate improv too. Whenever I bring it up, it gets a big scoff from Alexi. But I got into improv because of my love of American improvisers and the way they do it over there. Like, there is very little good improv in the UK, it has to be said. Apart from my team, of course, the Bazaar. We're playing Shoreham Rope Tackle next week, actually. I'll get to that later. American improvisers, America has the UCB, which is such a big boon. And American improvisers have gone on, like Tony and his peers, to become some of the best character actors and character comedians around the world, like Daly and yourself and Tina Fey. And
I would like to weigh in though and say I also hate improv.
Yeah.
I want to weigh in and say that most improv is terrible.
Yes.
Okay. True. And most American improv is terrible.
Okay.
And there is a certain point at which doing the art of that work on stage is you're running over the same territory. You cannot escape. The idea of doing it, I think initially, is you need to pursue a performance avenue, and whatever one gets you the most comfortable to pursue a performance avenue, you should do stand up, improv, whatever, if that's your desire to express. But the show I'm talking about, for instance, at the UCB East, that was all sketch. None of that was, I mean, even all the Trump Bernie, it started out sort of like the first few, we were working it out on stage, but then it was a script. And then we would go off of it.
Right.
I was lucky in the fact that I was in a good band, basically. I was in a group called Death by Ruru in New York, and we were really, really good. There was probably 1%, I'll be smug, we were like the 1% of what was good.
Mm.
And
same.
Even then, everyone was always aiming to write something and to make something, because improv is ephemeral. It goes away. And also, I think as time moves on, people, the audience feels this sort of Disney desire to have some sort of participation in the work. And I have no interest in having a bunch of slack-jawed morons be involved in the work I'm doing. I'm doing my work because I worked hard to do it, not for you, the audience, to be involved in it. Your involvement is to observe it.
Yeah.
And react to it. And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck that. Yeah. So like, so what I would say is like, yeah, we used to do a show. I mean, in this sense, this is how improv helped me. We used to do a show called Too Soon. And every Tuesday, one Tuesday a month, if something tragic happened, I would do it that day. Okay. So, you know, and it wouldn't matter what it was. I mean, one of them was very stupid, but it was Shirley Temple died. So that day I had her shooting heroin in purgatory with Philip Seymour Hoffman. And they were singing "Anything I Can Do, You Could Do Better." And her thing was that she shot heroin into her clitoris. And that's how she that's how she beat Philip Seymour Hoffman. So like, and, so, you know, I'm a firm believer in exiting the gravitational pull of improv, which is simply like a, it's always a great space to be in, to do, to work things out and to work and to keep your mind sharp and to be able to do that high wire act and actually be entertaining. Yeah. But, concrete exploration is important, right? Yeah. Like that's where it's really about, because that's how you're refining whatever the fuck it is to do comedy, right? Like whatever it is, whatever that meaning is, right? You know, I mean, we're almost on the poet's level in terms of being hunted down and destroyed.
So, well, you know? when I met you all those years ago, I was deep in the scene of improv, and then then I got out of it and been doing stand up and stuff, and then I recently got the call back a couple years ago. My friend was putting together the first Middle Eastern North African improv team, and asked to be in it.
But that's worth it too, because that's also like improv. Let's be honest about why improv's so boring. Because how many white men can stand around and talk?
Yeah.
How many white men? How much of that can you watch? I mean, we saw the State of the Union. It's the same bull. And I'm not being like wokey. I'm saying like, just straight up, I taught it. I'm a white man. I taught it for a long time. I was tired of hearing the same shit over and over and over and over again. And you look at the State of the Union, who are the three people spoke up? A black guy, a Sudanese, a Pakistani woman, and a Somali woman. Those are the three people who actually spoke up. While the rest of those lumps
heckled Trump.
The rest of those lumps sat there and took it for 2 hours, and I don't know what decorum they're showing by sitting there and taking it, but
apparently the Democrats also occasionally stuck, like when he crowed about releasing the hostages, and you know,
yeah,
they all stood up and applauded then, apparently.
Oh, that was the one time.
Yeah, apparently.
That's, you know, I know you say you guys get political, but like that's the dark shit to me. Everyone goes Trump, Trump, Trump. And I go, oh, the Democratic Party is the great failure in this country.
I agree, really. I mean, I just,
like the Labour Party here.
I mean, yeah, like the Labour Party here. You're very true. Yeah.
I mean,
Biden, in a way, seems like a much more evil old man than Trump always to me.
Yeah, well, if you think, because that's banality of evil, right?
Yeah.
That's the fact that you allowed a war, you passively supported and funneled billions of dollars into a war in Eastern Europe with no sort of game plan, right? Because you're really laundering money.
Yeah.
You went right along with Bibi and the horror that was executed for the last 2 years in response to horror, but it's all horror. So, and in addition, you had those Epstein files for 4 years. You didn't do anything about them.
Yeah, well, that's, absolutely. They're all sanctimonious about, you know, the fact that Trump appears in it, but at least he released the fucking things, which is not what, they've been sitting on them, as you say, for 4 years.
Yeah, all I know is Bernie Sanders would have finished his second term in 2024.
Yeah.
We would be probably looking at single payer in this country or some form of Medicare for all. And whatever this cancer is that grew in this country, which was necessary. I mean, I'll tell you my truth. My truth is this. If you lived in this country, you know, growing up as I did, none of this is surprising. Not Trump, the people who pretend that this is surprising. I mean, it's laughable. It's just laughable. You know, we made this bed, we put this guy here, and all parties involved were fine with it. Everybody was fine with it.
Can you just expand a bit on that? I mean, it's not surprising because...
It's not surprising because I personally believe you can continually trace it back and back and back, right? So, but we have to create sort of a false start point. So if we just look at the start point of like the mid-60s when Democrats were using the black church movement in order to foster social justice change, right? And so in the 70s, the right says, you know, we should probably start fostering evangelical religious support. So you have two political parties that start diving into the churches in order to turn out bases that will deliver votes for them.
Right.
And that in turn, the mega church model in the United States, this very particular thing, which I don't know if you remember that Andy Kaufman movie with Marty Feldman from the 70s, where he was this preacher. Oh, God, I can't remember the name of it, but it's a real wild, you know, there's a lot of takes that happen in the 70s.
In God We Trust.
Yes, in God We Trust. Yeah, oh, 1980, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what you see over the course of the 80s and Reagan's election is this erasure of this sort of papering over of our history in light of the quote unquote Soviet threat, which was a fiction that was invented for the election, right? And you know, we can go back and go, Carter's the one who got us involved in Afghanistan, not Reagan, right? So anyway, I'm going
not
all over the
Jimmy
map. Just
Carter.
Yeah, I know, not Jimmy Carter, right?
No.
I have it somewhere. I have a socialist pamphlet from 1978 going, get out of Carter's Afghanistan.
Whoa.
It's amazing. No, not he's Jimmy.
He's a good man.
So the U.S. So in my opinion, now as growing media ecosystems started to give us late night infomercials, performative talk shows, right? All seeding also this evangelical religious sort of undertone that was happening in the 80s that flowers in the 90s, you see a purposeful unseriousness in politics, right? Like an unseriousness in all areas. We want to make everyone accessible. We want to make Bill Clinton play sax, right? So that everyone will think he's a regular guy. And I think that was by design. It was by design to make politics seem unserious and to make our public welfare seem unimportant and to put everything on the same playing field as entertainment. And I think that was purposeful, personally. And so by the time and the Democrats, in the meanwhile, they never have gotten over the contract with America with Newt Gingrich. So Newt Gingrich, has this massive defeat in 94 victory in 94 that defeats the Democrats and changes the lesson learned from the centrist Clintons is we need to tack to the center, to the right.
Right. Same.
And that lesson has never, ever, ever been undone. Democrats are still running like it's 1994. But again, I, at this point, look at all these things as strategies for power, not as real governing. These are just simply strategies for power to retain power, to fill your coffers, because we live in corporate feudalism. I mean, I think
the reason I hate, in a sense, the Labour Party more than any, and the Democrats as well, is that they, I mean, at least the the Conservatives or Reform just exist to be pure evil, whereas the Labour Party or the Democrats, you know, exist to create people's better instincts and divert them into endless, pointless meetings or, you know, just, you know, the vacuity of the Democrats in the States, you know, empty gestures and hand-wringing and stuff like that. And I've forgotten the point that I was making.
I think that you made the point, which is that they are a sinkhole. Whereas at least, you know, I remember I went on CNN in 2015 or right early 2016, and they had us come on as Trump and Bernie, right? So we were sitting there doing this hit as Trump and Bernie. But I wanted to get something out on there. So at one point I just turned and I go, you know, white supremacists love me. You know, I'm very, I mean, this hostess was like, what?
This is just Trump. Yeah.
Yeah. And she went, oh, no, no, no. And she sort of, you know, you got the like, okay, we got to shut this kind of thing right. off. And I spat a little more out before they ended it. And I think I might have been one of the first people to just say he was a white supremacist.
Yeah.
But again, you could roll it back to the 80s that when people go, this country, this isn't us, this is us. We're a country that was built by enslaved people that then we fucking like shat on for the entirety afterwards. We're a country where we celebrated an interracial McDonald's commercial in like 2015. What are you talking about?
Yeah. A country stolen from brown people as well, who were treated like animals. Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah. So what's the comedy scene like over there? What's it like being a comedian? I don't know very little about how it kind of breaks down. I mean, do people do like, because I think sometimes a big American star comes to Edinburgh, to the Edinburgh Festival, and then does like 20 minutes because a lot of American comedians aren't used to doing like, I mean, when I used to tour, I'd do like an hour and a half, you know, in a theater and just be me.
Yeah,
Emily Stewart does like 2 hours or something in a theater, but I think a lot of U.S. comics aren't used to that. Is my information out of date? Really?
No, I think you're right. I think that stand up in particular in the States has gone through a number of permutations. I think you had a period of storytelling stand up that sort of happened in the early aughts where Mike Birbiglia, someone you might have heard of, he's sort of that ilk of like the storytelling.
Right. What was that? Sleepwalk with Me? Was that?
Yes. And I think a lot of British performance is more like that. I think it's more, not really true because who's that guy who's I did a show with him one time. He's very kind of this and he's
Michael
always,
McIntyre.
No, he's got a
head movement.
He's very, he laughs like that and he does a lot of crowd work and he's very spiffy. Yes.
Fuck, he did the show with Jimmy Carr.
Yeah, I did. I beat Jimmy Carr. I beat fucking Carr. Mopped the floor with him in some comedy joke thing Comedy Central. Well, I was thrilled. Yeah. And he was very polite at the end, of course, you know. He was like,
yeah, but he has that laugh that draws attention to himself. Yeah,
it's the Eddie Murphy laugh, isn't it?
Right. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's like 5 minutes. The comedy now, especially as crowd work, is this whole thing with like crowd work. It goes back to my contempt for the audience and this idea that I want to fucking talk to them.
Yeah.
Like, and so this is the new thing. You have a lot of people because comedy in the pandemic went to hits on Instagram and TikTok.
Yep.
So people started to not want to share their material. This is we want to talk about like my favorite thing about comedians' overblown idea sense of themselves. I don't want to share my material online because someone might steal it. So I'm going to show crowd work. And it's like, no one's going to steal your material, dude. Trust me. And even if they do, who cares? So sketch and improv was more like, I would say kind of like what's over there, similar in the sense that you had group. It's just you didn't have the same accessibility like your show. You know, I would say your show, you know, which has this hybrid of like sketch, right? Like you're you, but you're also
stuff or the my BBC shows. Yeah.
Your Alexi show, yeah. Yes. That show to me like lives in the Iannucci area, right? Where it's like you're you, but you're doing sketch, but you're doing commentary. I'm not saying they're the same. I'm just saying like and I think about Tracy's show, same thing, right? She's her, she's characters. That was very hard here. Do so if you were a sketch comedian, generally it was a troupe or a group, right? You're not getting, it's a very uniquely British thing, this idea of the individual, right? The sort of like, you know, what is it, the golden ass, like the story, you know, the single guy, the single character who's going through these tribulations and learning nothing, kind of, you know, that's a very British style thing. And
he
had not
the Chappelle show, he managed it, didn't he, back in the day?
Chappelle, I would say Chappelle is a rare example of that. and I would say Mr. Show, which I worked on with Bob and David, that was similar, but again, influenced by, you know, influenced by you guys. I mean, you know, that is also the other thing is when I think about what I watched when I was younger, it was Canadian and British comedy. It wasn't a lot of American comedy. It was.
How did you get? Well, first of all, can I just say I hate crowd work much more than I hate improv, or even more.
All right, there we go. We're scoring points here.
Crowd work is the fucking evil. Yeah,
it's awful.
And there's a guy here. What's he called? Paul Smith or something? Who's made a huge arena? Doing crowd work on fucking YouTube or whatever.
A fellow scouser, isn't he?
Yeah.
No, I have a few people I can name that I can't fucking stand.
Together. You choose together. What's your name? Anyway, sorry I interrupted you. Yes.
Oh, no. I mean, I was just saying that, you know, we would watch. I mean, obviously.
What were you watching growing up then? What were you watching?
Well, you know, obviously when I was little, I would watch Kids in the Hall and Monty Python, and I would listen to
more
Goon.
British stuff on the Canadian broadcasting. On
I would listen to Goons, believe it or not. Obviously, you know, Young Ones, which I think was on MTV.
Yeah, it's chopped up into kind of random order.
Yeah, not, it was not, yeah, it was not.
I never got any money for it, yeah.
No, well, my television show, I see 16 cents a year. And then Jam. I love Jam. I think Jam was series one was Jam.
What was that?
J-A-M. It was in the late 90s. All I remember, maybe we had a different name. Hold on.
Jam, TV series. That is from the Jam. It's written by Chris Morris, who we talked about a lot.
I thought it was, yeah.
Oh my God, Jam is the best. There's one where there's one scene that's just this guy talking about how he's going to sleep with this couple's daughter upstairs, and it is so fucking dark, and it is so funny. And, you know, what was it? Garth Marenghi, is that what it is?
Yeah.
And so, you know, all that stuff. So then,
I don't
of course,
think that was a big hit. Yeah, I suppose you saw it over there. You didn't know where it quite fitted into the kind of cultural lexicon, but that wasn't a huge hit.
We would get VHSs, you know, and we get them at cons. So you would get VHSs at cons, and of course, that's when I, you know, then when I started working with Matt, you know. At the time, I remember when I first started working with Matt Berry on Shadows, I sort of couldn't believe it. You know, I was like, I can't believe this. I can't believe I'm working with this guy, you know. And Natasha Dimitro is like, you know, really, really, I mean, everyone's really funny. But I'll say in particular, Matt was an amazing moment. And then, you know, then, of course, we became friends. We had a lot of similar sensibilities because I'm a big Whovian too. So like I've been, you know, I've been dressing like the Doctor since 1982.
Since Big Bang Theory kind of forefronted Doctor Who, didn't it? Felt like that came more central into kind of US.
But for me, it was on PBS and my dad used to, I remember my dad would sit me down in the kitchen and we would watch Doctor Who on the black and white. I remember the Lighthouse episode where there was this giant slug and it was black and white and Tom Baker's going up and down the stairs. And,
you know, Alexi was a big villain on Doctor Who.
Wait a minute. When were you, which series?
A Revelation of the Daleks.
Holy 19, shit.
19, the radio host.
You got even, you didn't know that. Yeah, 1985.
No. No, yeah. We, no, because we didn't ever get the radio stuff.
No, no, this is TV. This was TV.
Oh, it was TV.
Colin okay. Baker, it was the best, in my opinion. Oh, it was,
you mean
my opinion, the best.
Colin Baker's number six.
Yeah.
No, but he, his villain was a radio host kind of
I wasn't
of
a
guy,
villain.
Right?
I wasn't a villain. I was a hero.
Oh, forgive me. I don't watch that shit.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to have to go through my, I mean, I, yeah. you know, my DVDs are Key to Time and a variety of like, disparate videos, so I'll have to look through. Yeah, I have Colin Baker books. That's how deep I was into it. Okay. So
he was at, I mean, I did a Comic Con recently. I forgot he was there. He's not
how's he doing? Is he
not
okay?
Great, really. Well, he was walking on sticks and stuff like that, but then on the other hand, he had to go off in the afternoon and it was around about Christmas, so he was doing panto in like fucking Southampton somewhere.
Isn't that funny?
Working.
Now, anyone who's American who listens to this will not know that pantos are something that happen around the holidays.
Yeah.
And they're sort of like Christmas plays. They're often sort of like
bizarre British tradition, really.
Yeah. And they made their way to Canada, and pantomimes are also
really?
In Canada. Yeah. Because my friend Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall used to do the pantomimes.
I was never sure because I thought they had it in Australia as well. And then somebody told me that they didn't, because I remember I was making a movie in Australia once, and I seem to remember that I was in first class. And I was off. I was asked. Wow. Yeah, I know. Well, this is relevant to the story. I'm not just bragging. But I was offered the cabin steward. I was offered. He said, "You must come to the Qantas steward's Christmas panto," which is apparently like the gayest thing in Sydney, which is a very gay city.
Did you go?
No, I was the movie finished just before Christmas.
And did they say, "Now, sir, could you please return back to coach because we can't have you up here"?
Put down the peanuts.
But then somebody else told me that they didn't have panto in Australia, so I'm not sure. But you have it in Canada. What form?
Yeah,
form. Or?
Alexis is under the impression that you're fully Canadian. He was raised and born in the US.
I know, buddy.
Got Canadian family.
I know that I saw a few when I was little because my aunt was in the theater scene, but I could not tell you beyond the fact that there were a bunch of people in drag.
Yeah.
My memory of it beyond that, because
it's like Cinderella and
they'll do
Jack and the Beanstalk.
It's always like a, and that's why I remember being like, oh, that's my first drag. That was like my first drag when I was like, you know, 6 or 7 years old. You go, all right, you know. And also Canadian, I'll tell you, if you ever want to have a rewarding theater experience, go to Northern Ontario Dinner Theater. There is no greater comedy it's inadvertent. I'm going to say this. They don't mean it to be, but it is some of the greatest comedy you will ever see in your life. I have lost my ass watching Canadian Dinner Theater. My aunt, it used to be a big thing. My aunt and I would go, and we both kind of laugh, you know, snicker through the whole thing.
So what, you go to a production of Peter Schaeffer's Equus while people eat a three-course meal? Is that
the
idea?
But, I mean, fortunately, it would often be these sort of entrances and exits, you know, farces, you know, a man sleeping with one woman or whatever, but it was a lot of buffet blocking. A lot of farce, a lot of buffet blocking, a lot of people getting up and complaining about food in the middle of the show. But my favorite was I saw Fiddler on the Roof, and Fiddler on the Roof with Canadians, not a Jew among them. I mean, not one Jew, because there's no Jews in Canada. No joke. It was a guy who went, "It's tradition-y." And I went, oh, God, that was so funny. God, Canadian theater. So, Yeah. But anyway, I guess this was diverted from, yeah, I agree with you. I'm more mad at Democrats and Labor than I ever am at the fascists, because the fascists tell you exactly who they are. They show you who they are, and they go, and we are, and we're damn proud of it. Come at us. Come, let's go. Yeah. And if we keep shrinking from the fight, I think it is truly a belief in consumer comfort that is going to get us. Because I think we believe there is some way to get out of this. This is like being cornered. You know, you're walking home late at night and you realize you're cornered by somebody and you think you can talk your way out.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just can't talk your way out. Right. Yeah. You've got to figure out, and you might get your ass beat, you know, but you might have to. And I'm talking as a coward. I mean, I am a full-blown coward. I'm a frightened man. I have no martial arts training. But I do know there are situations even in my life where you have to push back in order to get out of the situation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that these folks are so comfortable, and I think they are having too much fun on island sex parties. You know, this is another one. Epstein's another one that I don't understand why people are surprised. I don't know about you. I lived through the 90s.
Yeah.
Why is everyone surprised about Epstein? People were openly parading around with teenagers at parties. Like, this is not some shock that powerful people are creeps.
Yeah, they are.
The shock?
Yeah.
What has happened to us? Because you and I, we lived the same time stream, basically. We lived about the same time stream. So why is it that the world we lived in that we know existed, why is everyone pretending like it didn't? Why is everyone pretending as if it was some beautiful egalitarian world where everyone was treated well, and then it all just fell apart because Donald Trump and one other guy? Yeah,
well, because they were complicit, I think, is the reason, isn't it? You know, I did have to check. I'm not in the files.
I am. I'm in the Epstein files. Yeah. Deepak Chopra recommended my show to Jeffrey Epstein. No joke.
Did he come?
Well, I'm sure he did privately.
Which I have to say, like, because we're coming up to an hour now, I have to say, when it came out, and I still regularly look at clips of it, like the President show, it wasn't big in the UK, sadly.
No, it wasn't big in the United States either, I should just tell you.
Well, it should have been, man. Well, it's so fucking good. Your impression, obviously, it goes beyond mimicry. You're like it's a full psychological breakdown of who
the man is. I saw it as an acting job, not as an impression. I just saw it as an acting job. Mm. I'm playing this guy, you know what I mean? Like listen, I'm proud of it because we predicted very accurately a lot of events that ended up transpiring. And so I really feel like there's two things I had. I had a sketch show that I wanted to do. So I wanted to get as much done in that sketch show as I could. And the albatross was I had to play Trump. That was the tax I had to pay.
I was curious
to do my show.
Kind of a poison gift that, you know, because
it was
this character, you know.
Right. So my tithing to that was, okay, I'll be as effectively. I didn't want to become the fodder for the Never Trumper folks. Like, I didn't want to become this thing that was like DNC folks were like, isn't he like really giving it to the orange Cheeto? I wanted it to be an attack on the system that put him in place.
Yeah.
And that's why I lasted one season.
But it is, you know, everything in me wants to see, hit, you know, ask. Yeah.
Get in British TV, I lasted four seasons.
Yeah. But it's called The President Show. You know, I recommend our listeners go look it up on YouTube, find the clips of it, and go seek out the full series. It was during Trump's first term, however, and you've got, it's like a late night talk show hosted by Trump with some like VT, some sketches in there as well. And you've got Mike Pence as your...
We sort of do a little bit co-host. Of Blue. We do a little bit of Tonight Show, a little bit of Blue Peter, a little bit of sketch. We sort of do a little bit of everything. So the show has pre-tapes. It has in camera sketches. We predicted January 6th.
Really?
So, wow.
Yeah, we predicted
January. Really?
Yeah, our final special was, I knew that they weren't going to do, so we did 24 regular episodes, and then we did two specials. And the second special, we decided to do a tribute to Time Trumpet. Mm-hmm. So we did Hindsight 2030 was our version. And it was a show from 2030 looking back on the last 10 years.
No.
And so we obviously we did not hit everything, but one of the main centerpieces of that show that ended up being memed a lot online or whatever was I wanted there to be a thing where he loses and he's in the Oval giving and the night he loses, we have a campaign speech and he says, I'm not going anywhere. I didn't lose.
Yeah.
So we did that in 2018. So almost verbatim, the night that he lost to Biden, he says almost verbatim what we said in the show, including even the stage positioning, like where Don Jr. is. Like we all wrote each other and we're like, oh shit. Right. And then we did a timeline from his loss in November to the inauguration of our fictitious candidate. And in that timeline, the broadcaster, and he goes, we got it off by like 5 days, but we had, they stormed the Capitol and there's a riot. What and we did hell? That and that people are rioting in D.C. So, and one of the funny things is,
do you
January,
feel somewhat responsible?
No, I don't. I feel like if anything, I do. I'm like, I wish someone had listened to anything that we had said in the sense that we gave an easy map to like who he was and how to sort of the whole, like his vulnerabilities and just nobody. I mean, I got called in, I mean, now I can say this stuff. Like I spoke to intelligence people at one point. I went to private Senate sort of, strategy meetings and tried to advise senators on how to like deal with him. I did like a lot of stuff for a period in DC where they would ask me to come help advise and no one would listen to me. I went to the Clinton campaign when they were like, we're winning. I went there in 2016 in this August of 2016. And Ronnie Mooks, who was her advisor, goes, well, we're winning by 7 points. And I'm like, you're not. I'm like, you're losing by two. And he's like, that's not our polling data. I'm like, you should stop listening to your polling data because it's wrong. You're losing and you're going to lose if you continue. And they literally kicked me out of the office. They literally told me to get out of here.
So what's it like? Yeah. What's it like now then being there?
I think that what it is now is because the United States is so large, you have this sort of, I feel like safety pockets, right? Like I'm in New England, New York. That's a safety pocket. I think what's happening that people don't understand is if the federal government is sending troops into American cities against the city's will, then there's already a form of civil war happening. It might not be overt, but at least at the minimum it is legal. So it is on paper a civil war because you have the states pushing back against the federal government. You don't have secession yet, but I wonder how long, whether they'll try to pull this ICE shit again in another city.
Right.
I think if they try to do it again in New York or Boston and it gets violent, I feel like we are on the precipice of some sort of probably great disruption, whether it's going to be economic or it's going to be civil. I just feel like we can't continue this way because people's pocketbooks will be affected and people's lives will be affected, and you can't live under that kind of stress for that long. And I think that if the election is stymied the way I think it will be, I think it's going to put the general population in a state.
What you mean by that exactly?
I think that they're going to work very hard to game the midterm elections, right, which would then take power out of the Congress. And I think that here's what I'll say. He's not going to – he's a psychopath, and psychopaths learn their lesson the one time.
Right. Yeah.
And so he's not going to let go of power without violence. That's just not going to happen. So – he will, even if the Democrats win, even if they go, fine, we're not going to send ICE to polling stations. We're not going to, we're going to gerrymander the best we can, but, you know, we're unable. And he's weakening too. I mean, he's old, he's weak. And I think much like what the Germans did with Hitler, where they kept trying to sort of figure out how to get him out of the way so they could actually run the Reich, right?
Yeah.
I think that you're seeing a very similar thing. You're seeing that they're learning their lesson. You know, we had all those old Nazis who came over to the U.S. right after the war to basically build our espionage space and advertising models so that we could become the new Nazi states of America. I think that this is the lesson they're learning, is how do we secure power as he fades?
Yeah.
So the question will be, how many more norms can be broken? So in the U.S., if the Democrats did win control of the House, would the executive just decide to ignore the congressional branch?
Right.
I think that that's where all the pressure points are being pushed, which are the places at which it changes norms so drastically. But until people can't get their seamless delivery, until people can't get their Uber Eats or can't get their Netflix, I don't think much is going to change. People are very well sated by their distractions.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's the probably most dangerous part of what's
unless ICE what's are coming. On your streets outside your house and then people were actually getting angry. It was like quite inspirational to see Minnesota's reaction to ICE.
Minnesota's reaction was incredible. And I'm sort of stunned that I'm not discounting the deaths of other folks, but I'm talking just in terms of American, the way Americans weigh things. So when I say this, it's about how my idea of how Americans weigh stuff, not what I think is important. A white woman and a white man got shot to death who were citizens. If that doesn't start to scare the people who are so like, they don't care. They don't care what happens to immigrants. They don't care what happens to brown people. They don't care. So I guess it's not until some white bro named Chad or some blonde named, you know, Cherry get killed and they're Trump supporters and they get shot through the head through the A on the MAGA hat. Maybe then finally they'll wake up to the idea that we're all chattel. But like it just doesn't seem like that's happening despite the fact that American citizens got shot.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. You know, what's Enoch Powell's Great Rivers of Blood speech, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, that's what the State of the Union was last night. I mean, might as well have been Rivers of Blood. It's
really,
just like
that racist.
Is that racist, that awful? Yeah. And I hope I've proved my bona fides as an American guest on a British show.
Yeah. fascinating insight.
Absolutely.
Thank God when there's got nothing like that going on here.
Fuck.
We can bask in it, yeah.
Yeah, my dad always said, when America sneezes, Britain gets a cold. So, like, you know, we are, you know, a few steps behind, but goose steps, I should say, because it's...
Yeah.
It's fucking coming. Thanks so much, Tony. Plugs time. I want to let the listeners know, please, about our Patreon, patreon.com/AlexisSalePodcast. We don't want to take adverts on this show. We never want to. Audio Boom keep knocking on my door saying, hey, we can have these adverts on your show and you'll get a few bob every 1,000 listeners. I'm like, patrons where it's at, please. Let's keep it pure and clean. Now, Alexis, that's the first time Alexis heard that. And I can his eyes, dollar signs in his eyes. So Kyle, sign up to the Patreon. We're actually, after we're done recording here, me and Alexi are going to record our first edition of Alexi Reacts. I'm going to play Alexi a video of some old shit he's done.
Oh, that's and a then, thing, isn't it? Reacting. And
then we're going to get your reaction to it. Tony, you could stick around for that.
You show them the puppet pilot sketch?
That's on YouTube.
That's a great sketch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh. Written not by me, but by Linehan and Matthews.
Linehan joint.
Yeah.
If you follow
Graham Linehan, you know, who also wrote The IT Crowd, which.
Oh, yeah, I know Graham.
Mapped to our attention, really.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, so right. I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry. I plucked him from obscurity.
He's Alexi's fault.
Yeah.
That fucker.
Yep.
Graham. Either going to be that or the roundabout, you know. The other option was going to be Where is it? Sorry About Last Night. There's a little clip from that as well. Anything, you know, and listeners at home, especially the patrons, email us, alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. Send me your YouTube links for clips of Alexi's stuff that you want him to react to. And then head over to patreon.com/alexisalepodcast. To support the show and watch those reactions. And then also, as I mentioned earlier, my improv team, The Bazaar, is doing Arabian Nights Live at Shoreham in the Rope Tackle, where me and Alexi are going to be back and on July the 30th doing a live AlexiSell podcast as well. Arabian Nights Live, if you want to see me and support my show, Friday, March the 6th at Rope Tackle. Tony, any plugs for you?
Well, later in March, we don't have a drop date yet, but probably mid to late March, Good Science with RFK Jr. and Kyle Quim will be that's his name, not for real, but his fake name.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll be releasing on iHeartRadio. I have no idea why they are allowing us to do this, but we are.
Oh, wow.
And you can always follow me and The Real Actual Tony. Or The Real Tony at patreon.com, which I rarely do anything on, but maybe I will start after this inspiring Patreon plug. And that's about it. I'm just over the moon to get to do this.
Thank you.
And to meet you is a real honor. So thank you for letting me be on. And it's good to see you. And, you know, if you ever need remote coaching, you let me know.
I am the coach now, as they said to Captain Phillips. No,
very impressive. Yeah,
I'm not in the improv scene anymore, and I don't take lessons and shit. I show up. We do our
good
show.
Man. You know
we
what?
We do our show, and then we get drunk.
That's the answer. God bless you.
Thank you. Cheers, but we'd love to have you back.
Yeah, it'd be great. I mean, your insights, I think, they come from a place that I think of real understanding of the society you live in, really, and it's a privilege to get that kind of granular kind of understanding of the United States, really, you know.
Thank you.
No, you're welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And now go back to coach. Now please go back to coach, sir.
I was...
I just have a couple of them little bottles of champagne.
Was I in first class? They used to invite you into the flight deck. I sat in the cockpit of that plane when it came in to land at Changi in Singapore.
No way.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's pretty great, huh?
Yeah, well, it was just a long time ago, but yeah. Well, especially when you come in and you bring a 7... I was flying that thing, basically. When you bring a 747 into Changi, it's a difficult approach. I'll say that. It's a difficult approach, Changi was then. You bring that big old bird around, you know. Extend the flaps.
This has so much more officiality because of your headset. It does look like you're a pilot.
So go to the Qantas Stewards Christmas Panto and
in Sydney. Yeah.
I landed that fucking jet at Changi.
I have my new pitch for you now, which is Alexi lands planes in flight simulators.
Yeah.
So you put them on a VR headset, and we have you. Have you go do the approach?
I have done that for a while. Not Westworld. What was it called? Westfield in Shepherd's Bush. They had a flight simulator.
Yeah.
Linda, I don't know if it's still there. It was pretty it didn't really move or anything. But it was a proper pilot. Did it we with you. And I lost my certificate. I was too excited. And I lost my certificate afterwards in the mall. But yeah, I brought what was it? It was a 737 and I brought it into St. Martin, the old Kai Tak Airport in Hong Kong. I don't know if you ever brought a bird into there. That was the was considered the most difficult approach because you had to fly between the tower blocks. So I brought a 737 into the old Kai Tak.
Wow.
And then St. Martin's, of course, in the Caribbean, which is a difficult, very difficult
737's tough because you get some stall out when you're throttling down and approaching. You're gonna get that stall out, that pull up warning. Yeah. You just gotta ignore it.
The 737 Max, I know. Well, you know. I know ways around that.
This is a great, this has been a great pilot podcast. I've been glad to talk about aeronautics and
Alexi's come to life in the last 2 minutes of the show.
If I had known this, I would have brought up my flight simulator info at the time of the show.
Yeah. Jesus.
Most deaf. All right. Thank you.
All right, guys.
Just let you get on with your day. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm not going to change anything. I'm going to wait.
Thank you.
No, but yeah.
Alexi hasn't said the magic words yet, though.
Oh, bye-bye. Oh.
There we go.
You've been listening to the Alexi Sale podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkuti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.